He is also the project director for the Comparative Effectiveness Research Public Use Data Pilot Project for CMS. And Dr. Erdem is also conducting an evaluation of the CDSMP for the Administration on Aging.
Thank you. Since the submission of that abstract, I moved to KPMG. This is another presentation on CDSMP process evaluation. I worked with Holly Korda and Sarah Peterson, who are here. The focus of this study is the CDSMP implementation during the ARRA recovery fund period between 2010 and 12. I should mention that the full report is available on the AOA website for your review. We use the same data as previously discussed. In the two-year time frame, we had about 90,000 participants in the U.S. In about 7,700 workshops. For this process evaluation, we didn't have data on health outcomes or patient satisfaction to look at the impact of what's happening. The question that I will be covering for this presentation is what were the factors that affected the completion of the program? Even though we do not see how the program affects people's lives, we could start with understanding completion and who completes and who doesn't, and maybe speculate why. This is already covered. Completion means going to at least four of the six workshops, which is defined by Standard University program, and that's what I will be focusing on. People can choose English or the Spanish version, and these programs are offered at different types of sites, faith-based organizations, senior centers, and so on. And there are two leaders who run the workshop. In the overall data set, we had about 74.5% completion rate during the study period. And understanding completion can allow us to improve the program and provide probably evidence for what's working. And in the next few slides, I will show you descriptive statistics by participant characteristics or workshop or implementation site factors and peer leader characteristics. So when we look at completion rates by gender and age, we see that females have higher completion rates than males, and there is some variation among the different age groups. It's the lowest for the 85 and older population. We are not doing statistical tests for the differences in these descriptive graphics, but you can look at the report for testing whether these are statistically significant differences or not. When we look at completion rates by race and ethnicity, we see that, for example, African Americans have 78.5% completion rate as opposed to 75.9% for whites. And we see that the rate spikes for Hawaiian natives and Pacific Islanders, but this is coming from a relatively small sample and workshops offered only one or two sites. So something special about those sites and those participants. We didn't find significant differences, at least here for now, between Hispanics and non-Hispanics. The purpose of the workshops is to help people with chronic conditions. So that's an important factor to analyze. When we look at completion rates by number of chronic conditions, ranging from 0 to 7 and more, among the 10 they enter in their forms, we see that it's about 65% for people with zero chronic conditions, but I should add that care providers can also participate in these workshops instead of the individual himself or herself. So that could be affecting our statistics here. if you look at the highest completion rate, 76.8, those are for people with 1 to 3 chronic conditions, and that's about 60% of our study population. On the other extreme, people with 7 or more chronic conditions is a very small population with about 75% completion rate. I mentioned that there are different sites that can offer the program, and when we come to the regression analysis, I'll show you that this is still a valid finding, and there are significant differences between completion rates among different sites. The lowest is at residential facilities, and the highest is in faith-based organizations. Workshop size. This came up in previous presentations. I think Stanford model suggests class sizes of 10 to 16 participants. So we included that in our analysis. And that's actually 48% of the time true in our population. But you can see a big variation in class size. There are some classes that are only one or two people in our data. And very rarely, it's about 20 people. And you can see the trend in the blue line, which goes down as class size increases. Leader experience. So we created a lot of variables from the raw data about leader experiences, whether or not someone taught the workshop before, whether the two leaders worked before, whether there was a workshop in the previous quarter at the same site, and so on, to look at the dynamic effects of leaders and the workshop sites. Because we do not know the full history, we cannot really find that if these leaders taught the workshops before. So for the beginning of our data, we are not sure if they taught the workshop before or not. So I have to add that as a caveat. But we see a slight positive trend in completion rate when we look at it by leader experience. So instead of looking at all these factors individually, we wanted to offer a multivariate regression analysis in which the dependent variable is a binary variable equal to 1 if participant completed the workshops and 0 otherwise in a logistic regression model. In the regressions I'm going to show you next, we exclude data for which we are missing a lot of the information because these are provided by the participants many times. They do not fill in their race, they do not fill in their age, and so on. So from 90,000 participants, we go down to about 50,000 observations in these regressions. What we also do in addition to the raw data is using external data sets, we create a metro, non-metro indicator to be able to control for that by using the zip code of the workshop site. Because we have a long list of right-hand side variables, I have 2 slides on the results. I just want to emphasize a few of them. If you look at the race category, you'll see that the African-American coefficient is 1.148. So that's about 15%. Odds of completion for African-Americans is about 15% higher than whites. And you see that huge coefficient for Native Hawaiians. When we look at age, this is expected, having seen the charts. It's the lowest for 85-plus age category. And 60 to 84 range is higher than also the base age category, which is under 60 here. We do not find anything significant between Hispanic and non-Hispanic participants when we look at by ethnicity. We controlled for participants who live alone versus who live with a caregiver or someone else in the home that doesn't seem to have a statistical significance. Probably more important is to look at the chronic diseases, given the purpose of the program. If you look at the chronic diseases with stars, depression has a significant negative impact on completion. So these people are much less likely to complete the program. Equally interesting, there are two chronic conditions that positively affect completion, hypertension and osteoporosis. And most other conditions did not have a statistical significant difference. The next set of factors are a combination of workshop characteristics and leader characteristics. We mentioned the type of site matters here. The base type of site that's excluded here is residential facility, which has the lowest completion rate. And the highest here is with about 60% higher odds of completion at faith-based organizations. Completion rates were lower in metro areas, which is probably counterintuitive given the difficulties of transportation in rural areas. Class zero, which is an important factor in the Stanford model, it's not significant at the 5%, but it's significant at the 10% level, as you can see by the p-value. It makes about a 5% difference in completion rate. Class size, you'll see that smaller class sizes have better completion rates, about 50% higher odds of completion in classes of less than 6 people. Spanish CDSMPs had significantly higher completion rates than English CDSMP. And when the public health was the lead agency, completion rates were again significantly lower. What else? So the right top corner, I think, is an important piece. What it shows is site experience matters. So that's a good complementary finding with the fidelity and sustainability of the program. If the leaders previously taught together, that had a statistical significant effect here in completion rate, as well as previous joint experience. If these leaders keep working together, that seems to have a positive impact. Given that I'm warned already, I'll move to the conclusion. We think completion is an important first step for the success of the program and other prevention programs. So we investigated this issue using statistical and econometric methods. We mentioned, and the details are in the full report, but some factors make a big difference in completion rates. The positive ones are the females do much better, African Americans do much better than whites. Some chronic conditions, like hypertension, osteoporosis, have positive, but depression has a very significant negative impact on completion. And other things that are worth reminding policymakers is the class size and the characteristics of workshops and the leaders for the success of the program. Thank you.
I guess what I wanted to ask. must you use an evidence-based program to get reimbursed, yes or no? What kind of outcomes do you expect to have? What is the infrastructure you have to deliver the program? So I don't think there's a right or wrong answer, but as an agency, you have to think, you know, what are the restrictions that you have? Now, Kate would say, particularly in low income area, small area, that some people are only doing eight. So I think you have to figure out what works in your setting for the kind of things you need. Evidence-based yes, no, the population you have, how much flexibility you want, and what kind of results you want to see.
And I would just add that every single one of the Tier 1 evidence-based programs that are being promoted through the AOA on their website, there's a list of, you know, probably up to 20 of those. They are all highly scripted. They are all very structured because that's the only way that they can make sure you're delivering the content that's been demonstrated to produce the effects. So that's the protecting the evidence base. So pretty much anything you run across, whether it's a matter of balance, enhanced fitness, you know, whatever they are, active living every day, they all have manuals that you can follow. And so you will still run into that, you know, those kinds of things.
I saw this lady first, and then I'll go one,
question.
Two, three.
For those of you doing research, when do you consider someone a participant? We in Vermont consider a participant someone who registers, but they often don't show up at a first core class. So we have a much lower completion rate.
The standard for Stanford is you must attend the first or the second class. So if you register but don't attend, you're not really a
participant. So your stats look so much better than ours.
Right. There's a huge drop off between registration and attendance. Did y'all say that you use that one? Have you attended first or second class?
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. I think this lady and then somebody over here. Yes.
So I'm just going to switch back to the DASH study that you were doing on your initial age scale, and I'm just curious, other than sodium reduction, what characteristics of the DASH study were you, of the DASH diet, were you actually measuring for? Because there are so many other components besides the different levels of sodium restriction, and you use those two terms interchangeably, so I wasn't really sure if you were really evaluating the DASH diet. Can you comment on that?
I can. And yes, so it was, I would say the scale that we present on here was more about reducing salt, and then there were some healthy behaviors, fruits and vegetables, follow a healthy eating plan, and reducing fats. So the new version of the scale that we're piloting, in fact, we've now included, we've revised some items, but we've also included more items to address the other nutrient components of the DASH diet. So in fact, it is... Yes.
That really accomplished the potassium, magnesium, the food composition. So you are actually reevaluating that with more of that. That would be forthcoming from some of your work?
Correct.
Thank you.
Correct. This lady here.
So my question is actually on a similar tangent. In terms of just how that question was stated and the knowledge, when you're asking about sodium intake and the effect it has on hypertension, how are you phrasing that question, engaging the knowledge of your participants for that? Because when I have patients and I'm assessing them for hypertension or how well controlled it is, they'll say, are you following a sodium-restricted diet? And they'll say, yes, I'm really watching my sodium. And then I follow up with, well, how much sodium is your maximum intake? And they'll say, well, what do you mean? I just don't put salt on stuff. And then when I actually find out, they say, well, I use sea salt, but that isn't a sodium. And, I gauge them and I do a one-day intake, and they're about 3,200 or 3,200.
We do not ask them, how much salt are you doing? What we're asking them are, how many days a week are you eating certain foods? So we'll have a list of foods that are known to be, like pickles. how many days a week do you eat bacon, ham, there's another processed meat I'm not thinking of, how many days a week do you eat? And so we're listing salty foods. Now, of course, that's still a little inexact, right? We're not asking them how many servings they're eating, or the serving size. But there's going to be some limitations when you're trying to get something that, in fact, you can use in a clinic office or that we can use on a large-scale telephone survey. I mean, yeah, we know doing that giant food frequency questionnaire really gives us great stuff, but it takes forever, right? So, I mean, we're trying to find some middle ground that's going to work. Yeah, that's a great question. I see 1, 2, 3.